Welcome back to just another episode of Just Another College Football Podcast. My name is Tommy Brzee, and today we're talking Week 13. Tons to get to, tons of good rivalry games that we need to get to. A little bit different of a format today. We're going to go through all the Power 5 conferences and break down the games of the teams that are heading to a conference title game this upcoming week. So a little bit different, a little bit of a preview within a reaction, but we're going to talk about all the games, we'll get into all the issues, and then we'll talk about some of the coaching carousel updates that happened this week. We will get to all of it. Let's jump right in. Alrighty, welcome into Just Another College Football Podcast. My name is Tommy Brzee, and let's jump right in because we got tons to get to, and we'll start with the conference that had their conference title championship set up last week, but the games this week were plenty entertaining. We'll start in Auburn, Alabama. Alabama wins a crazy one in Jordan-Hare, 27-24, and this just feels like every 2 years we get a biannual routine of an absolutely classic Iron Bowl game in Jordan-Hare Stadium. And this one, like all the ones in the past, it feels like made very little sense from the get-go. In the game, it made no sense. But going into the game, I mean, Auburn coming off a crazy, inexplicable loss to New Mexico State, and Bama just kind of rolling right along, getting all this playoff hype, people picking them in a lot of ways to beat Georgia in Atlanta this upcoming weekend. And I think all of us that have been around college football and have watched our entire lives knew that meant this one was going to be a classic, and that is exactly what it was. It was insane, and Auburn really kind of played a very similar game to what they did against Georgia. You know, Peyton Thorne was not good throwing the ball. He made a number of mistakes, did not have a good completion percentage by any means, but they were able to run the ball, and it wasn't perfect. It wasn't, you know, domination from start to finish necessarily, but they were able to find enough gaps. They were able to make, you know, enough plays to stay in this game. And then it came down to the big play, you know, the 4th and 31, 4th and goal, 4th and whatever you want to call it. And Jalen Milroe finds Isaiah Bond in the corner of the end zone. And the topic of conversation, well, other than, you know, how wild that play is just what Auburn was doing on defense. And, you know, I'm not someone that questions play calling very often, and I'm not someone that thinks they know better by any means, but Auburn did a really good job pretty much all game of, at the very least, keeping Jalen Milroe not comfortable in the pocket, you know, rushing different guys, keeping everything different for him. And they just didn't do that on the last play. They rushed two guys, for some reason left a spy on a 4th and goal play where there was no chance he was going to run the ball, and dropped tons of guys into coverage and still only had single coverage in the corner of the end zone. Now, I understand it's a very weird play. A lot of things are happening, but it just felt like Auburn did not, you know, get in their best play call for that particular play, and it was the one that cost them. And I think when you look back at this game as a whole, it was really the Auburn rushing attack, which we talked about, against Jalen Milroe. There wasn't a lot of offense for Bama outside of him. He has become really, from the beginning of the year when you thought they're going to have to win games in spite of him, now he is winning games for them. He is straight up putting them on his shoulders in a lot of ways and winning these games. And although, you know, the final drive wasn't perfect, nothing quite went perfectly for them until the final play, making those plays matter. And, you know, it was 2 years ago, Bryce Young was on his way to winning a Heisman, and one of the big moments was in the Iron Bowl, making the one play that mattered, that huge pass to Ja'Cory Brooks. So sometimes it's just about making that one play. Sometimes, you know, the start of the season, all these things happened to Jalen Milroe, and they were all pretty negative, and he found a way to overcome it and finish off his season on the highest note. And now they head on to Atlanta, and things get very, very interesting because tons of people picking Alabama, tons of people picking Georgia, two teams that at the beginning of the season, a lot of people were poking holes in, saying the SEC isn't nearly as strong, and now there's plenty of argument that Bama and Georgia are two of the four best teams, regardless of what happens this weekend. But Bama, when you come into this one, I think they have all the motivation in the world. They're playing the team that has, quote-unquote, dethroned them, according to a lot of people in the college football world, and they can kind of silence all of them on Saturday, and it'll be an absolutely classic game, and I cannot wait. And Georgia actually did not have to wait a week to get to Atlanta. They took on Georgia Tech in Atlanta at Bobby Dodd this weekend and escaped with a win much more comfortably than Alabama did, to be fair, but still escaped with a win 31-23. And this was a game that I think if you're watching it from a Georgia fan's perspective, it's very easy to explain this game away. They did not play their best game by any means, but Georgia played a style of game that was necessary to win this game, and I don't think that's really up for debate. I think they were way under their usual average of passes per game. They've only become more of a pass-heavy team as Carson Beck has become more confident, and they just kind of left all of that on the table this Saturday. Brock Bowers and Ladd McConkey didn't play, which obviously, you know, plays a big part in that offense, and that's not necessarily to diminish what Georgia Tech did on Saturday because it was wildly impressive, but that's just to say this Georgia team went out on Saturday and decided, let's win a football game. We don't necessarily need to do more than that. We don't need to be perfect. We don't need to even necessarily play everyone. But as long as we can get that win and move on to Atlanta undefeated, we'll be fine. And that's what they did. So Georgia keeps rolling. But I will talk about Georgia Tech here for a minute because partly because I grew up a Georgia Tech fan, and it's fun to talk about Georgia Tech in a nice light. Georgia Tech scored more points than anyone had against UGA this season. They came as close to beating UGA as any team has with an 8-point loss. And I understand there's no moral victories. It's, you know, doesn't much matter to the guys at Georgia Tech because, you know, they wanted to beat Georgia. But at the end of the day, it's hard to not look at this game and think, at the very least, Georgia Tech is moving in the right direction. And I don't know what that means going forward. I don't know if Brent Key can turn this, you know, 6-6 season into 8-4 next year and then keep moving forward from there. But what I will say is this team has been very good at executing game plans. They've been very good at knowing who they are. And they've done the little things correctly, which was a big problem under the previous head coach and was a big reason they lost some games that they shouldn't have and was a big reason they lost some games this year that they shouldn't have. But they do play a certain level of football that wasn't being played the last 3 years in Atlanta. So I think if you're a Georgia Tech fan, obviously you wanted to get this one. Obviously, this is, you know, the one. You wanted to ruin Georgia's season, but at the end of the day, there's tons of positives to pull from the season, and hopefully they can add a bowl win to that. But back on the Georgia side, I mean, this one, obviously Georgia running the ball a ton more in this game, and Kendall Milton and Dejon Edwards are just ridiculous. They're two backs that everyone would be talking about right now if they were healthy all year, but injuries were a problem early. They're finally back up to speed, and man, Kendall Milton is a problem. He had over 100 yards in this game, just absolutely dominated Georgia Tech in every way, and it felt like every time he touched the ball, 7 yards, 8 yards, 9 yards, it was just an absolute savaging, and I think they play a huge part in Georgia going forward. There was a lot early in the season that was put on Carson Beck's shoulders to make certain plays to win games, especially in the Auburn game. He had to make those plays. They were not going to be made by a running back, and now you do have the ability to beat teams in different ways to, you know, if your wide receivers are having an off day or the team you're playing just has incredible corners like Alabama does, and they will have this weekend, being able to go back to kind of that old school Georgia a little bit and run those backs over and over and wear down teams is going to be a huge part of Georgia possibly getting another title this year. And I, on the other side of the ball, Georgia's defense is finding their groove. I think the big thing for them and it's been a big thing all year, is just keep everything to the inside. Keep everything inside the tackles, or at the very least, inside your outside defender, because things get a little sketchy for Georgia once people get on the outside and can make one guy miss. And when you have Jalen Milroe and Jace McClellan and Jermaine Burton and Isaiah Bond and all of these guys you're going to have to face off with this weekend, it's going to be imperative that not only can you keep everything inside of you, but when you have the one tackle to make, you make that tackle, and you do not allow for yards after contact to pile up and Jalen Milroe to get confidence with his legs, because that could be a huge problem. But Georgia keeps rolling, keeps being Georgia, starts to, although this was a little bit of a hiccup, I think they're still playing, you know, incredibly high level of football, and this Saturday is going to be an absolute classic in Atlanta, like it always is when these two teams face off. We'll move right along to another conference that had at least one of their spots taken up before this weekend, the Pac-12, and we'll start with the team that needed to win this game to get in. Oregon absolutely rolls over Oregon State on Friday, 31-7, and this was just Oregon from the get-go. There was no chance that Oregon State was going to win this game, and I think in large part it played into that Washington game a week ago. I think Oregon State went into that game, you know, you have this chance to pull off something incredible. If you can win that game and then go into Oregon, beat Oregon, you could go into the Pac-12 championship when pretty much everyone had written you off and do this incredible thing. And I think it just took everything out of that group. I think they didn't really have much left to give, and I think it was very evident in this game. But Oregon, they just keep doing their thing. They make teams look a lot worse than they are pretty much week over week, and this was no different. Oregon State rushed for 53 yards on 24 carries, and that's kind of all you need to know about this game. It was just, there was no rhythm, there was no consistency. DJ made a couple of good plays, but it was tough sledding from the get-go. And Oregon, I mean, they can beat you in so many different ways, but it really starts with those receivers. Tez Washington and Troy Franklin are an incredible duo. I mean, when you talk about Pac-12 and receivers, pretty much everyone goes to Washington, and for good reason. Roma Dunsey had another crazy day, which we will get to. But I just feel like this Oregon duo is one that people are not talking about enough nationally. And when you get into those playoff games or the game this weekend, you're going to need as many weapons as possible. You're going to need to be able to beat teams as many ways as possible. And with Tez Johnson and Troy Franklin, they stand they can beat you any which way, especially, you know, with the running attack they have with Bucky Irving at the head of it. It's a remarkably potent offense that not only can stretch you out and, you know, make 50-yard chunk plays, but also they can have a 13-play drive where they go 75 yards and run the ball 10 times out of 13 plays, and it's just a grind-you-down type of style. So Oregon has been one of the more consistent teams in the country. That's why they've sat at number 5 for a while, or number 6 and number 5 for a while. They've been very consistent, really just kind of rolling since that Washington loss, and they get a chance at them this weekend. And I think all the motivation you need, obviously, is that first loss. And but if you're Oregon, I think you feel very confidently that if you win this game, you're in the playoff. If you win this game, you avenge the one loss that you have on the season. You look like the team that everyone is seeing. You have Bo Nix leading the way and being wildly efficient, making every single play, doing everything you could ask him to do. And I just think I think Oregon's coming into this weekend with a level of energy that is, you know, obviously going into conference title week, there is a different level. But I think Oregon, especially with that loss to Washington, is operating just a little bit sharper this week at practice, I'm sure. But on the other side, they will be facing Washington. And Washington survived against Wazoo this weekend, 24-21. And although they were already locked into the Pac-12 championship, and a loss here, I personally don't think would have affected their playoff chances. I mean, everything's so crazy now. It definitely could have, but I think if they would have won the Pac-12 championship after losing this game, they would have been in anyway, but who knows. But regardless, I think this was a huge confidence game for them. I think it's a game that, you know, you want to win because it's the Apple Cup, and, you know, you want to beat Washington State, and it's possible this game is not played a lot going forward, so you really want to win this game. But also, when you're going into a game against a team like Oregon, you need all the confidence, all the energy, all the, you know, you need to be able to walk in on Monday, and regardless of if it was, you know, a 50-point win or a 3-point win, at least see yourself 12-0, see yourself still unscathed, and know that you can walk in and beat anyone on their best day. So I think this is a big one for Washington. On the other side, I mean, the talk for Washington State all year has been Cam Ward, and he's one of those guys that is just incredible. He was far from perfect on Saturday, and I think he would be the first to tell you that, but the dude is the real deal. It sounds like he is going to be finding a new place to play college football after this year, and whoever gets him, get ready to take off. I think there's tons of teams that will be in on him. I think one to watch that just kind of popped into my head, actually, I think Auburn would be very interesting with Hugh Freeze and the offense that he runs. I think Cam Ward would really be very impressive, but someone to watch in the transfer portal world as that starts to heat up. But on the other side for Washington, this was another Roma Dunsey game. It felt like against Oregon State, without Roma Dunsey, they very well could have lost that game and probably would have. And it felt like this one was a lot of the same. They needed that guy to make pretty much every play, and he did. He is just out of this world. He's playing on a different level. Tons of people have said he's an NFL receiver on a college football field, and I tend to agree with him. He is out of this world, and he is as important of a player on this team as anyone, including Michael Penix. They need Roma Dunsey to kind of bring that entire group together. I think Jalen McMillan is great. Jalen Polk is awesome. They have tons of Westover is a great pass-catching tight end. But having that one guy that is the, you know what, no one's open, but he's always open type of guy, the throw it up and he'll make a play type of guy, is wildly important to have. And Washington has one of the best in the country in Roma Dunsey. So Washington continues their pretty much perfect season. It's not, you know, they haven't won every game by 50. They haven't been perfect every week, and they haven't really been perfect since the Oregon game. But, man, this team finds a way to win games, and it's hard to knock that, especially in the Pac-12 this year with how good it's been across the board. But they head on to Las Vegas this weekend with a chance to kind of prove a lot of people wrong, with, you know, a lot of people saying Oregon is going to walk in and roll over Washington. Oregon's the better team, but it just didn't show on in Seattle earlier in the year. I tend to believe Oregon is going to win the game, but I'll get into that on Friday. But Washington has a chance to end all of that, to go undefeated, go 13-0. Michael Penix could win the Heisman this Saturday with a remarkable performance. Roma Dunsey could win the Biletnikoff. They could finish their season perfectly and move on to the playoff, and it would just be an incredible accomplishment for Kalen DeBoer and the staff. It would be one of the best stories in recent years in college football, just what they've been able to accomplish with so many people waiting for the, you know, the next shoe to drop, the next Washington to finally get tripped up, to finally lose a game, and they've just been able to stay perfect, and it's been really impressive to watch. So they now have everything ahead of them on Saturday, and it's going to be on Friday they have everything ahead of them against Oregon, and it could get very interesting. I think that game, I think everyone agrees that game, maybe aside from the SEC championship, is going to be the game of the weekend, and I cannot wait for it. Alrighty, let's move right along here to the ACC, and let's start with a team that is being pretty much the talk of the town right now. Florida State hangs on with a big win at Gainesville, 24-15, and this game was ugly. I think we all knew it was going to be ugly by the quarterback situation on both sides. Tate Rodemaker did not have a great day. Max Brown, pretty much a lot of the same. But this game, in my opinion, was won by two players for Florida State, and that's Jared Verse and Trey Benson. Jared Verse was an absolute monster on the edge all game. 2.5 sacks is just ridiculous. And then Trey Benson gave this Florida State offense a pulse when it really didn't have much of anything. And huge credit to the offensive line as well for giving him the holes to run through. But this guy really just gave them an out in a game where it really looked like Florida had the upper hand in a lot of ways. They had this game kind of in control and just weren't able to, you know, keep it rolling. And Florida State was able to just make the plays that they needed to win, and that's a huge thing for them, especially in these last two games without Jordan Travis. It's about winning, and it's about, you know, keeping yourself alive and doing what a lot of people don't think you have the ability to do and finish off this perfect season without Jordan Travis at the helm. But on the Florida side, I think this is a very disappointing end to a disappointing season, and I think this is another team. I talked about it a couple episodes ago with Tennessee, but this is a huge offseason for Florida and for that coaching staff. They need to get some type of momentum. They do have a great recruiting class coming in as of right now, but huge emphasis on keeping all those guys intact and keeping that group intact, especially DJ Lagway at quarterback, is going to be a huge person to watch over the next month or so to see if Florida can, you know, get him signed, get him on campus, and get him rolling in that offense. But back to Florida State, I think huge topic of conversation lately has been, even if Florida State, you know, continues on, wins the ACC title, should they be in, given the injury to Jordan Travis? I might be in the minority. I'm finding more and more people tend to share that belief, but I think it would be wild if an undefeated Power 5 champion did not make the playoff. I understand there's plenty of arguments to be made that other teams would win on a neutral field or would be favored or, you know, have the prerequisite talent or whatever, or have the quarterback, whatever you want to call it. But Florida State has, they've answered every challenge that has been put in front of them. And if they answer this one, I think it's just very, almost unfair to keep out a team for something that is entirely out of not only Jordan Travis's hands, but everyone else's hands. They have no chance. It was an absolute freak thing. And I think punishing them for that would be, I don't know. I think it would set a bad precedent where a team could be rolling right along and then something catastrophic happens to their quarterback. And because, you know, they don't have the time quite late in the season to get the backup up to speed, that they get punished. But we'll see how that chip falls. They still have to go through Louisville, who suffered a tough loss this week to Kentucky in a big-time rivalry game. And this was really an awesome game to watch. This was a very back-and-forth, weird contest. And I think Kentucky, this was a huge win for them, especially because this was not a great season for Kentucky. I think a lot of fans came into the season with a lot of confidence. Devin Leary coming in as their quarterback was a huge part of that. They felt like he could take their team to the next level. And it just never quite coalesced into a ton of wins. And I think there were a lot of people around that program saying, this game is basically the bowl game. A lot of guys are not going to play in the bowl game. A lot of guys are already starting to portal out or decide to opt out and move on to the NFL draft, including Ray Davis, who made the big play in this one, a 37-yard touchdown to give the win for Kentucky. But it's a huge win, obviously, to just kind of lessen the burn of this season a little bit on Kentucky and at least give them some type of confidence heading into the offseason. I think Devin Leary was the big topic of conversation coming into the year, and he was really solid in this game and was solid kind of down the stretch of the season, just didn't quite hit that stride early enough for Kentucky to really do some damage. And I think But I will say he was good, especially late in this game. He made a huge mistake with the pick late, but then came back and led an awesome drive. A huge throw to Berrion Brown late in that one that was just an absolute dart. So huge credit to him for, you know, coming into this last game where a season that had to have been wildly frustrating for him, and just playing with confidence and letting everything fly is really awesome to watch. And I think Ray Davis, kind of the same thing. He's had a really special year at Kentucky after a couple of really good years at Vandy, and now he's moving on to the draft, and I think he'll be one of the top running backs in the draft, pretty much however you cut it. I think he's very versatile, can catch the ball at the backfield, can do a ton of different things. So he's someone that is definitely someone to watch in the draft process for sure. But on the Louisville side, the team that will be playing this next weekend, obviously they wanted this win. They wanted to be 11-1 going into that game and, you know, possibly at least have an outside shot at making the playoff if tons of things broke their way. But, you know, if you're Louisville, you still have the ACC title this weekend. You still have a ton of things to play for, but you're going to have to play a lot cleaner to get there for sure. I think the D-line was not nearly as disruptive as they have been a lot of the year on Saturday. Jack Plummer was not quite as crisp as he usually is. He was plenty good, but I think they're going to need a really great performance from him, and especially that offensive line to give him time to go through his progressions against that Florida State D-line this Saturday if they're going to want to get a win. But if you're Louisville, it's a tough loss, obviously, but you kind of move forward knowing that the goal that you really wanted this season, ACC title, is still ahead of you, and as long as you can take care of that this Saturday, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a Louisville fan that would be upset about this season. So I think the ACC title is one that is going to be a little bit less high-profile in terms of the teams playing in it, with Louisville, you know, not necessarily getting the national hype. But it's going to be a really good one. Florida State is going to have to, you know, pull out every gimmick, pull out every trick play or whatever they can, because this Louisville defense is really solid and can make things really tough on you very quickly if you let that D-line get comfortable. But I think this is going to be a really fun one at 8 p.m. on Saturday, and we will get a full breakdown on Friday's show. But the ACC is, you know, shaping up to be a fun finish in that one. We'll move right along to the conference that really had the most questions to be answered this weekend, the Big 12, and all of them were answered pretty easily. Texas rolled over Texas Tech on Friday, 57-7, and this was a very refreshing sight if you're a Texas fan. I think this was the first real complete win, start to finish, that they've had since the Kansas game in Week 5, and this one was really never close. Texas scored in pretty much every which way possible. They had a wild pick six return by Jett Bush. Quinn Ewers looked a lot more comfortable this week than he did last week. He wasn't perfect. He did have one pick, but he does look like he's getting back up to speed. But on the Texas Tech side, I think when you talk about this season as a whole, they were coming into it with just tons of hype. I think a lot of people were picking them to possibly be a dark horse candidate for the Big 12 championship and, you know, continue that momentum that was built up last year. And I think definitely a disappointing year in Lubbock. Definitely disappointing for them to not finish the way that they had pictured going into the season. But what I will say is I think they have the right head coach there in Joey McGuire. And in college football, that's a lot of the battle. It's a lot of you know, finding the guy that can lead your program the right way and put it in the right positions, and I think they found it. So although, you know, this season was not perfect, if you can keep things moving in the right direction next year, especially with a new Big 12 that might, you know, give you some more opportunity to be the new team that kind of takes over, I think is going to be huge for them. And, you know, they do have a solid recruiting class headlined by Micah Hudson coming in. So if they can keep all those guys on board and keep that rolling, I think things in Lubbock are still moving in the right direction for sure. But back on the Texas side, I think a big topic of conversation over the last 2 weeks was Jonathan Brooks going down for the year and who was going to step into that role. You know, Texas had tons of young running backs that hadn't quite hit their stride because of injury or other things, but C.J. Baxter had 100 yards against Iowa State last week. Jaden Blue had 100 this week. So two guys that are very young backs just, you know, stepping right into that role and not skipping a beat. And huge credit to that offensive line for, you know, run blocking at a level that they really hadn't early on in the season, and kind of getting more confidence in that and making it easier for these young running backs to succeed early on. But overall for Texas, obviously, incredible season, a season that Texas fans, including myself, have been waiting for a long time. You're 11-1 in Sark's third season, and I think if you asked any Texas fan, they would tell you that unless they were a little bit delusional or a little bit, you know, out of their head, they would tell you the third year was always the year that Sark was meant to do the big thing, was meant to bring Texas back to the level that a lot of people had come accustomed to over the 2000s and the 90s and everything. So I think there is there's got to be a lot of hope in Austin. There's got to be a lot of confidence. And although, you know, you did lose Red River to Oklahoma, and that's one that you won't be able to avenge with Oklahoma State winning a crazy one, which I'll get into in a second. This is a remarkable season, and as long as you can finish it off with a win on Saturday, I think all Texas fans, regardless of what happens with the playoff, will be plenty happy. A loss on Saturday would kind of spoil a magical season, but a win would obviously solidify what Texas fans have been waiting for a very, very long time. But the team they will face off against is Oklahoma State. They staved off a terrible, terrible loss that would have allowed Oklahoma to get into the championship. They beat BYU in double overtime, 40-34. And this game was wild. It was very much back. It was not even really back and forth. It was one direction traffic in the first half. BYU 24-6 at halftime, and that really should have been the end of the game in a lot of ways. I think BYU was they came out in the second half, and not that they, you know, were overly conservative or anything like that, but they just allowed Oklahoma State to do what they wanted to do, which was run the ball. I think Oklahoma State really struggled to do that in the first half, or at least get a rhythm doing that in the first half. And once you let Ollie Gordon get his feet under him, he is terrifying. So in the second half, Oklahoma State just absolutely took over, was able to tie the game, and then made enough plays. Ollie Gordon was absolutely at the center of it, as he is every single time that Oklahoma State wins. 5 touchdowns, and that's all the touchdowns that Oklahoma State had, and over 150 yards rushing. The dude should be given the Doak Walker Award tomorrow. It shouldn't even be a conversation any longer, and I'm sure he will be given it, but just a wild season from that guy, and someone who no one was really talking about, you know, week 4, week 5, and then he just burst onto the scene and never looked back. So huge credit to him. Huge credit to Mike Gundy, who just won Big 12 Coach of the Year. It was a very, very weird year for him and the Cowboys for sure. They started the year on a weird note. A loss to South Alabama by 26 points is not usually something that indicates a conference championship team. It's very, very weird that they're here. Even after they beat Oklahoma, they lose to UCF by 42 points. It's a really weird team. It's one of the weirdest teams in the country, and Mike Gundy is just one of those guys that gets the best out of teams, and he'd made every single adjustment that he possibly could have to put this team in the best position to win games. And although, you know, someone like Sark, who has done an incredible job with Texas this year and has brought them to the heights that they belong, I think when you talk about Coach of the Year, you do have to talk about, you know, what was done with what was given. And Mike Gundy pulled off something that no one really thought they could. So I really have very little problem, even as a Texas fan, with Mike Gundy being coach of the year in the Big 12. But he could really put a stamp on that if they can beat Texas in Arlington. If they're going to do that, though, they got to put less on Ollie Gordon in that game. Texas is one of the best rush defenses in the entire country, and no one's been able to really run the ball on them yet. Now, Ollie Gordon is the best running back they will have faced, but I think Alan Bowman is going to be the big guy if Oklahoma State is going to pull off a huge upset in Arlington this weekend. But we will get to that game on Friday, of course. And, yeah, I think it's going to be a very interesting game where Texas has a chance to get back on the mountaintop right before they leave the Big 12, and Oklahoma State has a chance to ruin that and make a lot of people around the country laugh very, very, very hard. Alrighty, let's finish up with the Big 10. And these is a very interesting situation because it's two games that, one, everyone was focusing on, one, I felt like no one was, and we'll start with the one it felt like no one was. Iowa wins an absolute thriller against Nebraska, 13-10, and that just feels like what every Iowa game is. You can pretty much put Iowa wins thriller against blank 13-10 over and over pretty much every single week. They find a way to win games. They don't win them pretty. They don't score a lot of points, and that's just the way they do it. They are very unapologetic about the way they play, and although being someone that gets a little bit frustrated with the Big Ten championship becoming kind of, I don't want to say pointless, but it becoming kind of the Ohio State-Michigan game becoming almost the pseudo Big Ten championship has been a little bit frustrating to watch as a fan. Iowa doesn't care. They enjoy the travel to Indianapolis every year, and this year is no different. They've been able to pull off a lot of really close games, even after that debacle against Minnesota where they got a game stolen from them. There's no real other way to put it than that, but they were able to pull off a ton of really close wins. And at the end of the day, if you don't have a great offense, being able to pull off as many wins as Iowa does is absolutely insane. So huge credit to that staff. On Nebraska's side, I think they're kind of like Texas Tech to a smaller degree, I would say, where the fans had some high hopes. You know, you have a new quarterback coming in Jeff Sims that was just a dumpster fire from the get-go, let's be honest. And then you have Matt Rhule coming in, who has turned around so many different programs and done incredible things at Temple and Baylor. And there's all this hype that you almost forget what team you have in the moment. And this coming from someone who has gone through a number of different coaching hires at Texas and has hyped them up beyond belief without really realizing where the program actually is in the moment. And I think Nebraska fans, I really do believe that everything is still moving in the right direction. They are still making progress towards what every Nebraska fan wants, which is just being in the conversation in the Big Ten. I don't think Nebraska fans are out here desiring a national championship in the next 5 years or anything crazy. They just want to be able to compete week in and week out and not have these seasons where they show up flat a lot of Saturdays. And I think Matt Rhule, at the very least, I can say confidently, has brought out an energy in this team that was not there before. Now it's a matter of winning the games that he has to win and not losing the games that would be, you know, that are dumb losses, taking out all of those. And then it's slowly making progress, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And when you're at a place like Nebraska where there is a lot of history, there is a lot of a huge fan base that wants to see winning football, and you want to give it to them, it's hard to give yourself adequate time to fix all the problems that are ahead of you. And I think Nebraska has a ton of problems that they have at least started making strides towards fixing. And as long as they can continually make those strides, including going into next year, I think they're moving in the right direction. So I think if you're a Nebraska fan, you're disappointed with this season. I understand it, but I think it's just important to keep perspective in how long it really does take to flip a script like this. But on the Iowa side, they are the team that will be playing. Will be representing the Big Ten West, which was a very weird division all year. But Iowa pulls it out. They will be heading to Indy. And it's funny because a lot of people, and I don't necessarily exclude myself from these people, but a lot of people after the Michigan-Ohio State game just pretty much almost penned Michigan into the playoff. Pretty much said, okay, so that's that. They've won the Big Ten. They've done their thing, and Michigan, you know, into the playoff. Iowa has a chance to do one of the funniest things ever on Saturday and blow all of that up. And it would be the weirdest thing because out of the, you know, five title games on Friday and Saturday, I think everyone would rank that last in terms of who could pull off the upset. But if Iowa can do it, you know, it would be the craziest thing that has happened all year in a year that has been plenty crazy, I think. And if you're Iowa, you know if you play elite defense, you'll have somewhat of a shot. So I think it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see what Iowa team shows up and if it's another, another Michigan team just rolling right over and moving on to the playoff, or is there some battle from the Hawkeyes this time around? But let's get to the final game. Let's get to the game. Michigan pulls off another win in this crazy rivalry for the third year in a row, 30-24. And this was about as good as college football gets. It was a game between two of the top five teams in the country, I think unequivocally. It was a game of inches, which is so classic with football. There were a couple of plays that made the difference, and I think Michigan just made those plays. And it's hard to, with all of the things coming into this game, it's hard to really fully encapsulate what was really, you know, all the emotions and everything going into this game. It was really hard to encapsulate all of it. And I think once you get into the game, you almost get lost in it. And by the end, you realize all of this stuff has, you know, all of the things that we've been talking about this entire year. You know, Ryan Day getting the monkey off his back and beating Michigan for the final time. Even over the past month, talking about Michigan and the sign stealing and no Jim Harbaugh and all of these things coming in. They all transpired in front of our eyes, and we really figured out just which team had the prerequisite, you know, like grit and the determination to take everything that was around this game and leave all of it outside the stadium and just kind of come in, play football, and execute what they want, what the game plan was. And that's what Michigan did. I think this is a game that Michigan, especially this particular group of players at Michigan, I don't know. I'm sure this is something that is, you know, sustainable and something that they can keep moving forward year over year. But I do think having guys like Blake Corum, having guys like J.J. McCarthy, having guys like Zach Zinter, who went out in this game hoping he gets healthy as soon as possible, I think he is out for this weekend almost for sure, but hoping for a speedy recovery there. But having all these guys in that room that can essentially just keep everyone moving in one direction. And it's a really, really hard thing to do when you're dealing with 85 scholarship athletes that are all 18 to 22 years old. And it's something that I think in a lot of ways, especially with Michigan this year, we've almost not talked about almost at all because of all the stuff surrounding them that has been so negative, that's been so anti-Michigan and devaluing what they've done. I think on Saturday, they kind of just were the better football team. There's really no other way to put it. You know, you can explain away some different things that happened throughout that game and throughout the past couple of years in these games when it comes to Ohio State, whether it's physicality or whether it's not having the interior D-line talent to hold up that run or whatever it is. I just think when it really comes down to it, when you're playing these rivalry games and when the margins are so thin, the team that comes out with, you know, their chest a little bit higher, the team that comes out with a little bit more confidence, a little bit more a chip on their shoulder, a little bit more anger, they tend to come out on top. And especially when it's two elite teams that execute at such a high level, the team that plays with more energy, that, you know, does the little things correctly, tends to be the team that wins. And it's hard to find a team in the country that does those little things better than Michigan. They play a style of football and a way of football that is so, I don't even know how to properly describe it fully. It's just, they play smash nose football, they do the things they have to do, and they do them so consistently that it becomes almost, we almost downplay what their capability is because they do these things almost effortlessly, and it's so wild to watch. But this game, I think, getting back to the actual game, I think this one really came down to a couple of mistakes on the Ohio State side that just weren't made on the Michigan side. And I think Kyle McCord is someone that not a lot of Buckeyes fans have to be huge fans of at the moment. I think the kid is plenty talented. I think he just needs more reps, and obviously this season was not great for him or for any Buckeye fan, you know, seeing the quarterback play they've had over the past couple of years. But he made two big mistakes in this game, and both of them were huge moments, really. Michigan was kind of struggling to get things going early on, and then Kyle McCord throws a pick, and Michigan comes down to score the opening touchdown, gets the crowd involved, gets everything just kind of moving in the right direction for Michigan. And then the final one, obviously, to seal the game and give Michigan the win. I think when it comes to Kyle McCord, it was far from a perfect season. But what I will say is I don't think he missed by as much as people are going to say he did. He was not great against either of the, you know, top defenses he played, and I fully understand that. But I think the kid has ability. The kid has a chance to, if he is the starter next year, which I'm very unsure of going forward, I think he has the ability to be a much better player. And I think, I don't know that Ohio State would necessarily regret it if they let him walk out the door, but I don't think it's necessarily out of the question. I think he would be coming into next season, and I'm sure is heading into this offseason with just a massive chip on his shoulder, a massive, you know, I need to get better, I want to get better type of energy. And I think that's all you really need if you're someone that is as talented as he is. So maybe I'm totally wrong. Maybe Ohio State will have a new quarterback in there by the end of the month. But I like Kyle McCord, and I think he has the ability to be a good quarterback for them next year if they keep him around. But someone else that a lot of Ohio State fans, I'm sure, want out the door is Ryan Day. And I understand. I fully understand that this is the game. This is the one that has to be won more times than it's lost at both of those jobs. When you're at Michigan, you win. If you can beat Ohio State, they love you. If you're at Ohio State and you can beat Michigan, they love you. If you can't, they hate you. It's really that simple. And it's been such a problem for Ryan Day, and this one was different than the other ones. I think the other ones, you had this very clear sticking point, which was you were getting beat at the line of scrimmage. The Michigan State offensive line was just bigger and stronger and more physical than you were, and it made it really, really tough for you to stick around in those games because they wore you down in so many different ways, so the second half just looked terrible. But this game, you had the physicality, you had the anger, you had the all the things that you were missing in the games before. You had it in this team, and obviously you don't have the crazy talented quarterback, but you also didn't necessarily need that this year. So I think it's got to be a little bit frustrating, especially for Ryan Day. I think more than anyone else on the planet, it's got to be frustrating for Ryan Day because this is the defense. This is the team that Ohio State's fans were picturing would beat Michigan under the same circumstances, and they weren't able to get it done. And it was really razor-thin margins that, you know, Michigan won and Ohio State didn't. But on the Michigan side, I mean, the amount of credit that should go to Sherrone Moore is insane. I think people are going to talk about it ad nauseum, and it still won't be enough. The dude stepped into a situation that, although, you know, no one has a lot of sympathy for Michigan, and I don't necessarily do either, but stepping into one of the biggest jobs in the country at the moment, stepping into a team that has, like, national championship aspirations, not just, they didn't just want to beat Ohio State, they don't just want to win this Saturday, they want to win the entire thing. And Sherrone Moore knew that if they stumbled pretty much at any point to get there, it was going to be a problem. So huge credit to him and everyone on that staff for just keeping everyone laser focused on what the assignment was, on what needed to happen, essentially. And huge credit to the players, as I touched on earlier, for just being the leaders that they needed to be. I think this Michigan team, it's hard to describe what they, obviously they have talent. Everyone has talent all over the field, and everyone in the playoff is going to have talent. Everyone that's in the conversation for the playoff has, in my opinion, has the prerequisite talent to win the championship. They have the ability. The question is, you know, what is your edge? What is the thing that sets you apart from other teams? And for Michigan, it's just the chip on their shoulder that I think you could argue doesn't even need to be there anymore, because they've been a playoff team. They've beaten Ohio State. They've done all these things the last 2 years. But they still, it's still there. It's still as big as ever. And it, you know, with Harbaugh coming back this week, everything is back to normal. It's business as usual. And I think they're going to go into that Big Ten championship trying to make a statement. We will get into that one on Friday, but, this Michigan team is very interesting, because I personally, you know, kind of don't want them to win. I'll be totally honest. I think the sign stealing and everything has left a little bit of a sour taste in my mouth. But man, week over week, it's becoming harder and harder to root against that group of guys and root against what they're doing in terms of bouncing back from something that, yeah, was their own fault, but at the end of the day, is a crazy thing to happen in the middle of a national title season, hypothetically, and be able to keep your composure and keep your focus to that level is really incredible. So huge credit to Michigan. Got to finish the job on Saturday, but everything that everyone had said going into this matchup, Michigan's got to be feeling great right now. Alrighty, we'll finish up with some coaching carousel notes. A little bit longer show, so we will speed through these a little bit. Mike Elko, the new head coach at A&M. This is a very weird 24 hours in this hiring. It was Mark Stoops for about 45 minutes, and then it wasn't, and then it was Mike Elko, and all of this happened in about 24 hours. But that's just college football and coaching hires. All of it has to happen so quickly that it's just wild. But as for this hire, I think it's a good hire for A&M. I don't necessarily think that it's they could have, you know, taken a bigger swing, could have possibly gotten a bigger name, but I don't necessarily know if they could have made a better hire. I think he recruits very well. He's a great defensive mind, obviously, and he recruited a lot of kids that are currently on campus at A&M because he was the defensive coordinator there, so at the very least, it brings stability for the time being and gives you some confidence that you can keep some of those guys around going into this offseason. But for Elko, he's not going to have, you know, 6 years to figure it out like Jimbo Fisher did, because of the prerequisite talent is there, and because they're going to have a sour taste in their mouth after last time. So he's going to have to get things running pretty quickly there, I think. Connor Wegman getting healthy as quickly as possible is a huge part of that, so that's something to watch throughout the offseason. But I like the hire for A&M, not only from a football perspective, but from a fit perspective. I think it just makes sense. Another one I really do like is Jeff Lebby taking over at Mississippi State. This just feels like a Mississippi State hire. For years, they were a team that was going to stretch you out and try to beat you in different ways because they didn't have the prerequisite talent. So they had to get dynamic on offense. They had to get weird and throw the ball a ton, or, you know, just motion, spread people out, do weird things, basically. And Jeff Lebby is, you know, another one of those young offensive minds that loves to mess around with play calls, loves to motion a ton of people, play, you know, tons of different styles, but isn't necessarily this, you know, super air raid, can run the ball really effectively. And I think he brings a ton to this Mississippi State team and this program. The question now becomes who is going to be his quarterback, because Will Rogers has said he is going to enter the transfer portal. So it'll be interesting to see who he can get as his quarterback. And I think it's going to be huge for him because his contract details were leaked yesterday. And it looks like if he can make a habit of beating Ole Miss, which has not been an easy task in Starkville recently, but if he can pull that off, he'll be bringing in about $1.5 million a year. So it would not be too bad for him at all in Stark Vegas by any means. But another MSU made a big-time hire. They got Jonathan Smith, Michigan State. And this is huge news for Michigan State, not only because I think they got a great coach, but also you just get good news at Michigan State for the first time in a while. I think that program has been under so many different waves of bad news that it's great to see them kind of moving in the right direction. And I really do love this hire. I think he makes sense in the Big Ten. I think with all the success he had in Corvallis, it's hard to overlook that, especially because Oregon State is not necessarily – they're a program that has popped up at different times and has had like scattered success. But it's really impressive what he was able to do there. And you know, in the world of the transfer portal, there is tons of talent on that team that could help Michigan State get out of this, you know, talent hole that they're in the Big Ten compared to everyone else. So I think this is a big-time hire for Michigan State, and we'll see if this can kind of, you know, close that gap a little bit in the new era of the Big Ten. And finally, we're just going to finish with kind of a funny one. Bobby Petrino is back at Arkansas State as their offensive coordinator. And that's just wild on so many levels. It was about a decade ago that he was sent off from Fayetteville in not a very nice way, in totally his own doing. And he finds his way back, and it's just so weird. But another situation where he will need to find a quarterback. It looks like KJ Jefferson is going to find another place to play college football. So if you can find a quarterback that fits his system, I think they could really turn this offense around pretty quickly, because I do like Bobby Petrino as a football coach. I think he is a solid play caller, and I think he would be I think he'll be effective at Arkansas. Granted, he can get the right quarterback in there that, you know, can execute what he wants to execute. But one final point on this, I just think it would be remarkably hilarious if he has any sense of humor, basically. He should show up to the press conference in a neck brace. There's no way his agent or PR team would let him do that, but man, would that be funny, and I would love him immediately. But that's all I got for the coaching carousel. I will be updating this weekly, so this will be a regular part of the show going forward. But crazy times in college football, not only on the field, but definitely off it as well. Alrighty, that will do it for this edition of Just Another College Football Podcast. Getting up to almost an hour here, so I should get out of here. It's been definitely a longer form show, but tons of information to get in. Going into a crazy conference championship week, still tons to figure out. I will get into all the matchups on conference championship week and my reaction to the college football playoff rankings on Friday, so thank you so much for listening. Tune back in on Friday, and I will see you next time.